This is Robert Martellacci, the Mindshare Learning Report, Canada's leading learning and technology e-magazine. We're fortunate to have joined us today for a Mindshare Learning Moment for our December 21st Century Spotlight, Dr. Michael Barber of Wayne State University and author of the recently released study, State of the Nation, K-12 Online Learning in Canada. Dr. Michael Barber is originally from Newfoundland. He is currently living in Windsor, Ontario. He completed his PhD in instructional technology at the University of Georgia. He is currently assistant professor in instructional technology at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Thank you for joining us today, Michael.
Oh, not a problem.
Wow, that seems like quite a comprehensive effort you went through in putting this together. Now, it didn't happen overnight, and this is actually the fourth of in a series that you've been doing over the years?
Yes, we started back in 2008.
And what was the impetus for this study?
Well, being a Canadian that's involved with K-12 online learning and had been at that stage for almost a decade, I guess to put it bluntly, I was always a little annoyed that there was so much that we knew about what was going on in the U.S. and how little we knew about what was happening in Canada, when if you look at the Canadian context, you know, we've been using distance education at the K-12 level for a long time, and we've been using online learning for a long time, just as long as they've been in the U.S., and at least in the early years, probably much more than what they were doing in terms of the actual amount of usage that we had here in Canada. But this was all sort of an untold story. So back in, actually it was at the 2007 Virtual School Symposium, I approached Allison Powell and Susan Patrick with the International, or what was then the North American Council for Online Learning, it's now the International Association for K-12 Online Learning, INACL, about essentially doing a report that would be similar to the Keeping Pace with Online Learning report that John Watson had been doing in the U.S., but for the Canadian context, so essentially a province-by-province look at what was going on and the type of regulation and activity that was occurring. And that first year was a little rough, I'll admit. We didn't get any of the sponsors that we had hoped, even though we had a pretty good list of folks to contact. So that first year we actually titled a snapshot because, you know, without any funding, we basically were able to do a little bit of research based upon some of the connections that I had already had throughout the country and some of the ones that INACL had made, and INACL actually bore the cost of publishing that first report, and I thank them very much for that. And but by that second year, we had a sponsor come online with Connections Academy, and we've added a couple of other sponsors each year since, and it's allowed the report to essentially grow and become more comprehensive, and each year we're able to find out more things, and even things that got overlooked previous years.
Oh, fantastic. Well, perhaps there's something we can help you out with last year, in the coming year. And, you know, it's a bit of a surprise that Stats Canada isn't doing more in this area. I think there needs to be greater leadership. Incidentally, we just launched the C21 Canada, which is a spinoff of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills in the U.S. And I know we'll be looking to for opportunities like this, you know, when it comes to 21st century learning skills. But sorry, I digress.
I think with Stats Canada, one of the things that we have the difficulty here in Canada is that education falls under provincial jurisdiction. So really the only sort of federal organization that would really want to do this kind of thing might be the Council for Ministers of Education, but they have next to no budget whatsoever because it's basically just what the provinces want to put in. And individual provinces aren't necessarily that interested because they have a good sense in many instances of what's going on in their own province.
Well, it's, certainly, you know, we're happy to help facilitate that in the future because you're doing great work. Now, this being your fourth study, what is most striking to you when you compare this recent study to previous years when it comes to K-12 online learning in Canada?
Well, I guess the first thing is the proliferation of K-12 online learning that we've seen, and the trends that we've seen in that proliferation. basically just before the first report was published, so probably about 2006, 2007, that was sort of when we had the big growth in the number of online programs that were available and the number of students that were being served. Interestingly, the number of students, while overall in Canada has gone up this year, depending on which province you look at, it's actually gone down in several of them, in some cases quite significantly.
Interesting.
A third of the students that were there last year aren't there this year. But I guess this year, really, we were proportional to the United States in terms of the number of students that were engaged in online learning. So for the 2008-2009 school year, both of us were sitting at about 2.5% of all K-12 students were doing one or more online classes, whereas this year, that number for the U.S. Is about twice what ours is.
So are we laggards when it comes to the adoption of technology in education in some regards?
No, I wouldn't describe it as that. I think the big difference, I would believe, has to do with how online learning gets used in both countries. In Canada, in all honesty, it is still used as a substitute for face-to-face learning when face-to-face learning isn't practical. In most instances, that means practical due to geography. Although, depending on the size of the school, you have a lot of urban schools that practicality means solving scheduling conflicts, or students that simply don't work well in a traditional environment, you know, four walls, desks in a row, teacher in the front kind of thing.
Right.
In the U.S., it's really become it rolled into an ideological movement that is essentially trying to reform public education along free market principles. And thankfully, that's something that we haven't really gotten into here in Canada. But that's where you've seen a lot of that growth in the U.S. happen. It's got tied up in the choice movement and different initiatives that neoliberal, neoconservative educational reform movement have been pushing.
Interesting. Now, let's touch on Canada as a global leader when it comes to online learning. We were early out of the gate. We are one of the most connected and first connected countries when it comes to education. How are we doing on the global stage?
I think we're doing quite well. While the numbers might not bear it out in terms of the percentage of students that are enrolled in it, if you look at the types of models that you see here in Canada, they're models that I see being replicated around the world. I was fortunate enough to actually be one of the authors of the two recent INACL reports that looked at essentially what was happening internationally. One was a report that was essentially a survey of 50-odd countries around the world looking at what they were doing with online and blended learning. And then the second one was a case study book that we had, I think it was 9 case study authors came through and talked a little bit more about what was happening in each of those countries. And
I
look at what's happening in each of those jurisdictions and compare it to the things that we've been doing here in Canada, even before we moved into the online sphere, you know, when the folks in British Columbia, for example, were still providing correspondence education to the Lighthouse schools back in, you know, the teens and 20s. You know, when the folks at Memorial were developing the telemedicine Tetra network and running that audiographic system down there, which was used for both primary or post-secondary and high school courses. You know, these types of things, I think, really put us at the forefront.
Amazing. And sometimes a well-kept secret, because as Canadians, we tend to be a little more humble, don't we?
Very much so. Very much so.
Now, let's talk about blended learning and the evolution of that model. I did my master's in ed tech at Pepperdine. It was very much a blended program where we met as a cadre, we forged their learning community, and then we spent a lot of time using Tapton and other tools like Skype and etc. Are you seeing the uptake? I'm seeing some trend toward that in some regions in Canada. What did your study glean?
Well, I guess there's a couple of things to say on that front. First of all, I really do have a problem with the term blended learning, because in all honesty, when I look at what we describe blended learning to me, that's just an example of the successful integration of web-based technologies into the classroom. It's stuff that teachers have been doing for in some cases, 2 decades already. We've just now decided to call it something else because it's either, you know, politically convenient for us to add numbers to what's happening. But to answer your direct question, because we are seeing some trends like that in Canada. If you look at the Center for Distance Learning and Innovation in Newfoundland as an example, all of the courses that they offer in an online format, any student and any teacher in the province can request a login to their system and use all of their course content free of charge. In the case of New Brunswick, they actually have about 30% of the people that are registered in their course management system are students that are taking the class in a face-to-face format, and the teacher is just using the online content that's hosted in the LMS, kind of like another textbook, you know, right. Simply another resource. The eLearning Ontario program has recently, I think it was just this past summer, announced that students or school districts would be able to use their online system, both the LMS and the content that they've got made available, in a blended context. So we're seeing, you know, more and more of it happening. The program, that Learn program that you find in Quebec, the vast majority of their students that use their resources aren't students enrolled in their synchronous courses. They're students that are using these asynchronous resources that they've put up there for tutorial reasons, and in many places, teachers actually using them as part of their, you know, curricular offerings.
Well, that's... Now, what about the territories? I mean, they have been at this for quite some time. Our spotlight for the December issue is on the Canadian territories, and it's really out of necessity, and they really do benefit from the access to online resources and tools.
Yes, and this is actually a good example of where I think the line between blended learning and successful technology integration really does blur, because if you look at what's happening in the territories, when I talk to the folks in the ministry up there, they tell me that they're not doing much in the way of distance education, that they're not doing much in the way of online learning. But when you start talking to them a little bit more and looking at what their schools and individual teachers are doing and how they're using the internet as a way to open up their classroom so that the students, you know, can connect with people from all around the world and have access to all kinds of resources that they wouldn't otherwise have, you know, they're doing some wonderful things up there. But, you know, if you were to call them up and say, well, can you tell me what you're doing with online and blended learning, they'd tell you, well, we're not really doing all that much.
And meanwhile, they've been at it longer than, you know, the southern folks, no doubt. What's the future of learning management systems? There's a lot of talk, a lot of buzz around that these days.
I suppose until we get to a point where there is almost complete interoperability, where I can basically easily take content from one and stick it into another, I think that, or, you know, simply just put it up on a Google Sites website, they're still going to be around. And I think the biggest thing that LMSs have to offer right now is simply that, in addition to the actual repository that they provide and the learning management functions that's in there, they provide support for these things. So organizations don't have to build their own expertise and their own capacity to be able to support these things. It's, I think, one of the reasons why you haven't seen Moodle get the sort of widespread adoption that you would assume it would. I mean, you've got a free LMS out there. Why wouldn't every university and every school be using this as opposed to some of the proprietary ones? And the reason is because that in order to use it, you have to be able to, you know, maintain it, to administer it, and to support it. And that takes a certain type of expertise, and it's difficult to develop and then hold on to that expertise.
And that's not truly the core business of education. I mean, they're in the business of teaching students, so...
Yeah, and unlike some jurisdictions where, you know, I could hire a computer science guy to be my techie at the school, one of the things that you find in Canada is the people that are running our school networks and that are, you know, responsible for all of these technologies that you see in the school are in most cases teachers, and in a lot of cases teachers that have no computer science training whatsoever, at least
right.
Formally. You know, they're just the guy on the staff that happened to be the most savvy with computers. You know, he or she were the ones that were tapped on the shoulder and said, okay, you're going to be our tech person.
Yep. And now with the advent of cloud computing, I think that's going to make things a little easier, take pressure off some of these schools that have been dealing with networks, etc. What's your take on cloud computing?
Well, I think in terms of being a backup system, I think it is an absolute necessity. I did my sabbatical last winter in New Zealand and spent, I was actually based in Christchurch, and I showed up about 3 weeks after the
earthquake
that they had one in September, which really didn't hurt the city all that much, and then mostly just the surrounding areas, and then they had one in February that
was quite devastating.
That basically, you know, wiped out pretty much the entire central core. It closed just about all of the schools, and even still now, half of the schools in the city aren't open, and, you know, they're double bunking. You know, where one school uses the physical site from 8 till noon, 8 till noon 30, and then another school comes in at around 1, and they'll stay there till about 4 or 4:30 or 5, and, you know, that means they only have 80% of what they would normally have in their instructional time. It puts great demand on the actual physical building, you know, and it eliminates a lot of the things that I think keep kids interested in school beyond the academics, if you think about all the extracurriculars that you would normally do. But
right.
Because you don't have access to the building anymore. And one of the biggest things that they found there was that for the schools that were, like, severely damaged, their entire student information system, you know, all of their school electronic school records were on a computer that was sitting somewhere in the school that was now flattened under, you know, hundreds of pounds of debris.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know, so in cases like that, I mean, you know, while I don't think schools in, say, the Toronto District School Board are going to, you know, end up losing all of their information because of an earthquake, you never know what can happen.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, we call them disasters for a reason. You know, you can't predict them, and
yeah,
the results tend to be catastrophic in most cases. And while I can see some need to continue to maintain your data locally, because let's face it, the cloud isn't always available, having that backup somewhere on the cloud, I think, has got to be an absolute necessity for folks.
Absolutely. So although you're a Canadian, you have the benefit of a different perspective being based in the U.S. If you could make one major change to learning in Canada, what would that be when it comes to ICT?
Well, I suppose the biggest change that I would like to see, and it's not necessarily something that I would take from the Americans because I don't really see them doing it all that well either, but this notion of providing home access to the technology. You know, if you look at, say, the cyber charter schools in the U.S., they're probably a good example of this because these are kids that are doing 100% of their studies online, so they don't come to a physical building, and instead the online school gives them essentially a laptop or a desktop and gives them a subsidy to pay for their internet. And that's something that, I mean, if I could adopt one thing that some of them are doing down there, that would probably be it, because while we have great capacity here in Canada, it's only capacity if you can get onto it. You know, so when you look at folks that, say, live in the Parkdale region of Toronto, which is, you know, one of the lower socioeconomic status areas of Toronto, or, say, the east side of Vancouver, there's
right.
a lot of folks there that don't have home internet access. For that matter, if you look
right.
at the Canadian North, there's a lot of folks up there that don't have home internet access. Even though, to use, say, Labrador as an example, you know, Labrador has some of the fastest internet in the country. You know, largely in part because of the Smart Labrador project that went in there with the Canary funding that they got from the federal government. And
amazing.
That's only useful if I have the ability to access it at home. Because a lot of these types of things that we're talking about, you know, particularly if you're looking at having courses online, taking strain off of the school buildings, being able to do more in the physical classroom because the students have done so much of the work at home, all of those things are sort of predicated on the ability of the student to access the materials at home.
Well, interesting perspective there, and certainly, you know, universal access is always a challenge, and school to home connection is often discussed. Let's look at the skills gap. What is the risk for provinces in not making online learning a greater priority, and the potential impact on preparedness for post-secondary learning and 21st century global digital citizenship, for that matter?
Well, interestingly, actually, the use of online learning doesn't necessarily prepare students that well for online learning later in life. At least the research doesn't show that anyway.
Interesting.
Dale Kirby and Dennis Sharp and I actually recently did a study, presented it at a couple of conferences now, and it's going to be coming out in the American Journal of Distance Education early in 2012. But essentially, we looked at students that had taken courses in high school as part of the CDLI, and then basically students who were taking distance ed courses at Memorial University, and seeing if there were any differences between their work habits, their enjoyment of distance education, their expectations to it, and there were no differences. The students that had not had an experience learning online in high school did just as well as, or better in some cases, than the students who were, you know, had that experience. And in all honesty, this really shouldn't be all that surprising. You know, what we've seen with online learning, at least the research, both in the U.S. and in Canada, although in the U.S. I think the student population is changing significantly, and it isn't changing as much in Canada, but the type of students that were attracted to online learning were the ones that were going to do well anyway. They were going to be successful. They were going to gain these skills if they were something that they needed for their work or for their learning. The students that didn't simply didn't take online courses. I think part of that is because if you look at the history of distance education, it initially started off as a way of essentially catering to students that were largely in rural areas that didn't have a science teacher or a math teacher or a second language instructor.
Right.
You know, and so you were looking at a very select population of students. And in all honesty, I would suggest that in Canada, that still forms a large portion of the students that are enrolled in online courses. In the U.S., it's starting to change because you've got a much greater number of students that are enrolling in these cyber charter schools, and most of those students tend to be at-risk students. But even in the U.S. context, you still have a very bimodal distribution of students. You've got a bunch that are your best and brightest, and then a bunch that are taking the courses for the second or third time, or they've, you know, dropped out of the traditional school setting, or they just weren't having success in there and have decided that they wanted to try a different option. There's not much of that middle, and let's face it, the vast majority of our students are that middle-range student.
Who would you say are the top three provinces when it comes to embracing online learning?
Well, I guess a lot of it would depend upon how you defined embracing. I mean, I can say that British Columbia by far has the highest level of activity.
Right.
About 12% of their students are engaged in one or more online courses.
Wow, that's amazing relative to the average.
Yeah, I think the average in Canada right now, if I remember the report, was about 4.5%, 4.6%. Yeah, so they're looking at about three times the number. But part of that is also the legislative structure they've got. In British Columbia, the funding automatically follows the student. So if you have a student that's taking a couple of classes in their face-to-face school, and,
right.
Well, I think they do six classes, actually, in there. So every FTE is actually carved up into seven pieces. One-sixth for each of the classes the student takes, and then if the student is taking something online, the school can actually get an additional unit for what they call distance ed support. So if you have a kid that's taking, say, four of his classes from the school and two of his classes online, the school gets 4/7 of the FTE for the four classes they're offering. The online school gets 2/7 of the FTE for the courses that they're offering that student is taking. And then the school can get the other 7th because, you know, the student still has to be in the building supervised using electricity. electricity and, you know, all those other soft things that
right.
still cost money. So because of that arrangement, I think, and schools can't block a student from taking an online class either.
So now,
it's entirely up to the student.
And I believe that's the case in Alberta as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Not the funding model, no.
The funding does follow the student. I thought they can have option to. They're a little less strict on movement and choosing other schools, whereas in Ontario, you have to stay within your jurisdiction.
Actually, that's not quite correct. In Ontario, they actually have a system like most of the other provinces do when it comes to funding, where, you know, if I am a student, say, with the Calgary School Board, the school that I'm at in the Calgary School Board gets my entire FTE. If I want to enroll in two courses through the Alberta Distance Learning Center, the Alberta Distance Learning Center actually charges my school a fee for me to take those classes.
Okay.
Very much the kind of the U.S. model that they use for supplementals.
Right.
Now, in the case of Ontario, they actually have a system in place where the school gets the entire FTE, and then the school has the ability to enroll the student into the offerings that are being provided by that particular district's e-learning consortium, or that e-learning board. So say if I was in, well, here in Windsor, Essex, St. Joseph's High School is or Catholic High is about, I don't know, I could probably hit with a rock actually from here. And, you know, I've got a kid there that, say, might be doing five classes. I don't know how many they do here in Ontario, but I'm going to just use five as a round number. The kid might be doing, say, three classes at St. Joe's there. Now, the entire FTE will go to St. Joe's. What happens is the Windsor Catholic School District, or Windsor Essex Catholic School District, if they have an e-learning program, and they do have a small one, they'll fill that up with their own students first. If they have any extra capacity, what happens is they then offer those spots to any other district in the province
right.
that wants to enroll their students in those courses. And they can do the same. So, you know,
and then they just charge him back.
St. Joe's there.
Yeah.
If he's doing, say, three courses from St. Joe's, maybe doing one course from the Catholic Board's e-learning program, and then they might be doing, say, one course from the Toronto District School Board Virtual School.
Right.
The district would have to pay the Toronto District Virtual School, or the Toronto District School Board Virtual School, I believe the number this year is $640.
Wow.
For each semester enrollment. And
okay.
It's actually written right into the agreement that eLearning Ontario signs
yeah.
to each of the boards that participate that says, you know, if you enroll your student in a course that's offered by another board, you have to pay this amount. Now, what some of the districts have done in Ontario is they've come together and formed these consortiums. So you've got the Ontario eLearning Consortium, the Ontario Catholic eLearning Consortium, and now you've also got a Northern eLearning Consortium. And one of the things that these consortiums have agreed to do is to waive the fees for other consortium members.
Right. So
the idea being that eventually it'll all just wash out. You know, this year my district is enrolling 12 students into other districts and we're taking in 10. Next year it might be the other way around.
Yeah, sorry, I was referring to physical movement. Like, I see your point about the online courses, but my kid isn't able to go out of our boundary to another high school.
Whereas, oh, no, not physically, no.
Yeah, so that's what I was referring to. So getting back to performance, and so we have a sense of who's leading, but who needs to pick it up? Who's towards the bottom when it comes to embracing online learning in Canada?
Well,
statistically,
it probably shouldn't strike you as any surprise, but the smallest user of online learning at the K-12 level is Prince Edward Island.
Okay.
But then again, they also have the smallest population, and they also have the most centralized population, or one of the more centralized populations, because let's face it, you can drive from east to west in 2 hours
yeah.
and north to south in about 45 minutes.
But proportionately?
Proportionally, I think they're still at the bottom as well, or close
okay.
to it, if you exclude the territories, mind you.
Right.
you know, the territories are at the very bottom. And but I think, again, one of the reasons for that is because when you call them up and say, well, what are you guys doing, you know, they think of distance education and blended education as being, they don't equate it with that technology integration that we were talking about earlier. So, you know, when I call up the guy from St. Nunavut in their Department of Education up there and ask him each year, he tells me that, you know, well, we're not really doing anything on that front this year. So I think actually this year the report says that there's approximately zero students enrolled in online courses in Nunavut. In the case of the Northwest Territories, they have a small video conferencing program, plus the Beaufort Delta Educational Council has just started up a little distance ed program that's doing some video conferencing and using an LMS. Similarly with the Yukon, they've got about, I think it's 20-odd students that are enrolled in a video conferencing program that's offered, I think, three courses now or four courses. And then all three of those territories have agreements with various programs in the South. Like Alberta Distance Learning Center has agreements with all three of those territories, and they have particularly a lot of their French and their French immersion gets done online through that. The Northern British Columbia Distance Education School has usually about 60 to 80 students from the Yukon that they'll enroll each year.
So what's most promising when what comes out of your study? What excited you the most for Canada when it comes to embracing online learning and the future of 21st century learning?
Well, I guess the thing that I don't know if I'd use the term excite, but the thing that pleases me the most is that we haven't jumped on that U.S. bandwagon of, you know, this is the wave of the future, so we need to have all of our students doing this. We have that recognition that, for some reason, the Americans can't see that, you know, teachers play a major role in this process. And by this, I mean the educational process. You know, that relationship that a teacher has with the student has a significant impact upon their learning.
Thanks so much for your time today, Michael. That concludes our podcast interview with Dr. Michael Barber, Wayne State University. Be sure to check out www.mindsharelearning.com to get your latest issue of the Mindshare Learning Report. My name is Robert Martellacci, and until next time, keep the learning curve steep.